It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, moving into your first house can be a big thrill, but maybe less so when you get those hard-to-answer questions like, how do you keep the basement from flooding? Or how do I arrange the bills? Our guest teaches us some Homeowners 101. First, the Trump administration announced plans to reduce the number of refugees the U.S. will accept in the 2019 fiscal year. The new cap of 30,000 is down from the current year's limit of 45,000, and that number was the lowest since the Refugee Act was passed in 1980. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in announcing the move that it will allow the U.S. to process the claims of asylum seekers trying to enter the country and focus on the cases of refugees who are already here. He also said it will ensure those coming into the country get properly vetted in order to maintain national security. Elise Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Green Bay's Sheboygan campus. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here, Rob.
Well, can you put this news, this new level of refugees into perspective, looking back at the few decades of this refugee program? How is this comparing to what we've done in the past?
Yeah, as you said, this is the lowest ceiling that we've had on our refugee admissions since our resettlement program was created in 1980, and it's a reduction by about one-third from the dramatically lowered cap that the Trump administration had put into effect for this year, which was 45,000. So this is really something that I think his base and the supporters would see as fulfilling his campaign promise to really crack down on all types of immigration, not just illegal immigration, but also legal types of immigration.
Now, we hear this 45,000 refugee limit for the current year, but just over, as I understand it, just over 20,000 have been admitted. So even that cap, we're not getting there. Is that right?
Right. So what this cap does, it's just like a ceiling, which in the past, administration set it as a goal. What's supposed to happen is that the executive branch would consult with Congress in setting this goal. What we saw last year with the lowered cap at 45,000 was that members of Congress were sort of upset that the Trump administration hadn't really consulted, but had sort of publicly announced that lowered cap, and then after the fact, almost sort of notified Congress, you know, by the way, this is the cap that we're going for. I anticipate a similar reaction this year because it seems like we're publicly already discussing this much lower cap before any formal consultation with Congress has occurred. But you're absolutely right. It's just a cap, and so you can fall far below that as we have this year. We're not even to 21,000, even though the cap had been 45,000. So in lowering it to 30,000, a lot of refugee resettlement agencies are worried, well, this might mean even well below, you know, 20,000, 15,000 could be the actual end result.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said this move was meant in part to let the U.S. focus on moving existing refugee cases through the system. Here's part of what he had to say.
The daunting operational reality of addressing the over 800,000 individuals in pending asylum cases demands renewed focus and prioritization. The magnitude of this challenge is unequaled in any other country. In consideration of both U.S. national security interest and the urgent need to restore integrity to our overwhelmed asylum system, the United States will focus on addressing the humanitarian protection cases of those already in the country.
I want to sort something out there because he's talking about wanting to focus on asylum seekers in the United States while we're cutting down the number of refugees. Those are not synonyms, right? Those are two different categories. Can you explain the difference, Elise?
You're exactly right, Rob. So our asylum process is something that happens either at our border or once those individuals are already in our territory. And those are the people we call asylees. Those are the people that would be currently what the Pompeo is referring to as overwhelming, as he says, our immigration courts. The refugees are overseas, and we only accept refugees who have already been vetted and meet the international legal qualifications according to the United Nations Refugee Office and our own Department of Homeland Security vetting. So our refugee process is entirely separate from our local sort of border asylum process. We have domestic courts, immigration courts, which are overseen by the Department of Justice that handle those asylum cases. Those are not involved at all in the refugees, which is the State Department and other government agencies.
So is there any notion that, hey, if we spend less resources, fewer resources on refugees, we could put that into dealing with asylum cases? Or are they so separate that there really isn't a spillover effect?
Yeah, that's a great point. The backlog that is discussed in terms of our immigration courts means we have not enough immigration courts judges to really hear and give adequate time to hearing all of the asylum claims being made before deportation proceedings. Because those judges have nothing to do with the refugee processing, and indeed those refugees coming from overseas are vetted by totally separate agencies, there's really no way that the immigration judges could have their casework reduced in any way by having less refugees. I think the common denominator is for people that would support both kinds of policies, reducing asylum at the southern border and reducing our immigration in terms of refugees, is that it would lower the number of foreigners that are allowed to enter into the United States.
Talking to Elise Cohen from the UW Green Bay Sheboygan campus, looking at the announcement from the Trump administration that they are lowering the ceiling, the maximum number of refugees the United States would accept into the country to 30,000 in the coming fiscal year. Elise, talk us through, we've talked about this before, but talk us through who can become a refugee, what it takes to qualify for that status.
Yeah, so that's another really great point of confusion for a lot of people, of thinking about refugees as just one type of legal entry into the United States. In order to be a refugee, we have an international legal definition where they must be facing the threat of a well-founded fear of persecution or harm, oftentimes even a threat of torture. And this is based on maybe political opinion, race, religion, nationality, or social group. We also see that for our refugee program, they must go through a very intensive security vetting process that in the past took anywhere up to 2 years in order for them to go through and really qualify. So what they have in terms of differentiating them from other types of immigrants is that they are really a humanitarian category. They're fleeing for their lives and survival, and that's what makes refugees different from other types of immigrants that may be coming for family reunification, work, or education opportunities.
Can you talk about the, demand for refugee status? I know it peaked a couple years ago, driven largely but not exclusively by the war in Syria. What are we seeing this year?
Yeah, once again, we see the global refugee numbers are growing. So right now we have an unprecedented number of displaced people in the world, including over 25 million refugees. And we do see Syria remains the top source of where those refugees are coming from, with over 6 million coming from Syria. Afghanistan, Somalia, Myanmar, these are other major sources of the global refugee crisis right now. So while the demand is growing worldwide, what we see is the U.S. is sort of retreating in the last 2 years from its share of global refugee responsibility sharing. In the past, we've been the leader of the global resettlement regime. I think since 1975 alone, we've accepted over 3 million refugees. And so the global resettlement of refugees really depends on the U.S. contribution.
As we start to wrap up, Elise, we're talking about numbers in the tens of millions this year. We're talking about taking in refugees in the numbers of tens of thousands in the United States. Other developed countries are taking in probably smaller amounts. So where are all of those refugees who aren't getting status, getting accepted into the United States and other developed countries?
Yeah, the most of them are languishing sort of in temporary status, waiting to see when their life can begin anew in what's called refugee camps. A lot of the conditions of those camps you can read about easily in the news. They're really horrifying in terms of the level of quality of life. The other thing to keep in mind is we have countries like our neighbor to the north, Canada. They have about a tenth of the U.S. population, but this year they're on track to accept more in sheer number in terms of refugees than the United States is. So there are some countries that are doing a lot based on their population size. Unfortunately, it seems like the U.S. is really reducing our role in that.
Elise, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here, Rob.
Elise Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at UW Green Bay's Sheboygan campus. She joined us to talk about the Trump administration's decision to cut the number of refugees allowed in the United States next year by 15,000. Right now, buying a first home is still seen as a big milestone for a lot of people. You get to make the space your own through decorating, painting, remodeling projects maybe. But there are a lot of things new homeowners don't know to expect and often don't know how to handle. From a leaky faucet to those squirrels in the walls, this can all be new and mystifying. But across the nation, different colleges and housing nonprofits are creating classes to try to better equip new owners. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a seasoned homeowner, what do you wish you had known or thought about when first moving in? Call and share maybe your DIY stories or embarrassing mistakes. And if you're a new homeowner, what questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jason Hafman is with us, outreach manager at Project Home. Been with the Madison nonprofit since 2009. And Jason plans and schedules Project Home's free home maintenance classes, including things like basic household plumbing, cost-effective energy improvements, and very timely, how to prevent basement flooding. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Well, how overwhelming is that new first house for a lot of homeowners who are taking the plunge for the first time?
It is very overwhelming because you go through the whole process of getting financing and it's exciting and you're trying to find the right house. And then you get done with all of that and you walk in and you have no idea what most things are. That's the way most people approach it. I mean, I remember my first house. It was a 1920s home, great bones to the structure, but no insulation in the walls, very under-insulated in the attic. It was freezing cold in the winter, overly hot in the summer, and some other challenges as well. So they don't give you a manual, unfortunately, when you buy a house.
Now, you run classes at Project Home in Madison. We were seeing in the New York Times people who are able to afford housing in New York, they're looking for classes too. There seems like a demand for this kind of information.
I think so. I mean, it's really important at least to know the basics of general maintenance and just an understanding of where your mechanicals are in your home, where your water heater is, where your furnace is, what are the main triggers for those things. Like a lot of times there's a dedicated outlet or switch for a furnace, for a water heater. And if that gets flipped, it's as simple as flipping the switch back to make it work again. And other people don't realize that. And they call a technician to come out, they get charged for it. And all it was a simple flip of a switch. So knowing those basic things, including your electrical box, those are really important to start.
A good starting point, at least for me in the past, is usually when you buy a house, you get it inspected. And that inspection report is kind of a nice blueprint to start with. Is that something that you recommend people do?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think it's pretty standard. People do inspections now whenever purchasing a home. It is important. Obviously, it doesn't catch everything. And if you're a homeowner, you know once you get into it, you learn kind of the quirks and the special features of your home, right? But every house, there's something. And there's always maintenance to do it, no matter how new it is, how old it is. But I think having a basic understanding of building science, how insulation works, how your heating system works and those type of things. And then just some general spring and fall maintenance can really make a big difference as we approach the fall season. And then as we get out of the winter season, like things to look for with your gutter cleaning, with things around the foundation, looking for areas water can enter, air can enter. Those are important things to just kind of keep an eye on.
Oh, that's a good timely place to start digging into specifics now. Mm-hmm. For that person who's in their first fall season, or I guess we've got a few days till fall yet,
yeah.
What give us a walkthrough of what we should be doing.
So a lot of it is looking around the exterior. So walk around the exterior of your home, look to see if and this is where a lot of the basement flooding comes in from rainwater, not the kind of epic flooding we're talking about that we've experienced around waterways, but when you have just general rain and you get water in the basement, okay? You want to look for the ground sloping either flat or sloping towards the house. Those are areas you won't need to address, and usually it's pretty simple, just getting some topsoil, filling in, creating a slope to grade away so the water runs away from the house. The other things are looking at your gutters, making sure they're attached, making sure downspout extensions are attached, making sure they're cleaned out. And then look for things like around your dryer vent. Is that clean? That's a thing you should actually do pretty much monthly. Check your dryer vent to make sure that the lint isn't getting clogged up on that exterior port. A lot of people don't even know where that comes out of their house, but if that gets clogged up, that can be a fire hazard. So just getting in there, cleaning the lint out of the end of that every month is important. A lot of people don't do it over the winter months, but if you can get it right before fall, you know, that's a good time to do it.
And a common problem for a lot of people is, you know, that minor plumbing problem. And you've got a class on the basics of plumbing. What are some of the things that you recommend people try to figure out how to do for themselves?
Sure. I mean, simple things like changing a faucet, changing a toilet. Once you have a basic understanding of how to do it, maybe the right materials and supplies to use is something that most people can do. Not everybody, but most. And, you know, it hadn't been something I had done until about 5 years ago, my first toilet change. And the only thing I would advise, and I think there was in this New York Times article too, is do your first one on someone else's house, just as a little, but, you know, do it right. But anyway, I did mine on my parents' home. But it was great to understand. And the class we have, that one in particular, is by our plumber. So he knows how to do all kinds of advanced things, but really breaks it down to here are some simple things to do most homeowners can do. And the other challenge that we're seeing right now in the trades and how short-handed everyone is and how busy all the trades workers are is for something simple like that, it would be difficult to get someone to come out to your house to pay them to do it, to even take that job if it's a smaller job. So it may be, as we move forward, something people are going to have to learn to do.
Talking to Jason Hafeman from Project Home. He runs a series of classes for homeowners. We're talking about homeowners 101, the stuff you need to know when you get that first house. You mentioned energy conservation. Talk about that insulation that wasn't there in your first house. What are some good basics, again, with winter coming up that we can tackle maybe as a do-it-yourself project?
Yeah, so looking first in your attic. A lot of people don't look in your attic, but annually you should look in there. At least poke your head up through the attic hatch, find out where that is, and just look around. Look at the underside of the roof deck so you don't see any staining or active leaks or signs of that. And then just kind of checking your insulation levels is really important. And you can do that with a tape measure right by the attic hatch and see what kind of levels you have. Generally, for our climate, you want to have about 12 to 14 inches of insulation minimum in your attic. And if you have, you know, we've been in attics where there's 2 inches of insulation, and those are highly under-insulated. You can go certainly more than that. You can go all the way up to probably about 20 inches and still receive a good benefit from that insulation. But attic insulation is the key to maintaining a good temperature in your house in the wintertime.
Can you talk about what kind of difference that can make on a heating bill?
Oh, it's huge, you know, because the way the heat leaves most homes is through the ceiling space into the attic space and out. So the more you can do, and it kind of works together, you also need to look at air sealing. And this is why kind of weatherizing homes has become a bit more of a science than it used to be, because we have to actually test and find out where the air is leaking and stop those quick air leaks, which is usually around light fixtures, where wall plates come together, where any electrical or plumbing penetrations go through the ceiling into the attic space. That's where quick air leaks out. And if you have an older home and you have a big chimney going through there, normally those chimney chases are huge air leakers. So it's sealing up those air leaks first, which you can do with the caulk sometimes or expandable foam. Chimneys are a little trickier, but there's a process for that. And then adding insulation on top of that, that's where you get maximum benefit. It helps maintain the heat in the house, and then you've got a warmer home.
What are some of the other most common questions you run into with that first-time homeowner?
We hear, you know, questions across the board. And that's one of the things we were talking about our class series today a bit, is that one of the most beneficial parts of it, we have content, we put together a topic, but the biggest part is people bring their personal questions for their house, and we can answer those questions. And each house is different, and each house works differently. So when you have that one-on-one time, and we can bring up a scenario, and then usually, even though it may be a little different at someone else's house, they experience something similar. We could all learn from each other in those classes. That's why we love it. But man, we just hear questions across the board. How do I fix this? What about my siding? What about my windows? How do I deal with my furnace? And we try to get people at least to have some base knowledge. So even if they can't do things themselves and they're hiring the work, they know the right questions to ask a contractor, so they hire the right contractor.
Now, some people are naturally handy, or they grew up doing this kind of stuff. More power to them. That's not me. Do you think some people are kind of shy to want to ask for help? Like, I don't want to look dumb. Everybody should know how to do this basic thing.
Absolutely. I think there's kind of that sort of perception that everyone should have this base knowledge of things, but reality is they don't. And so that's one thing we have nice with our staff and any of our classes. If you come out, there's not a dumb question. We will answer any question, and we'll spend as much time as you need to get you kind of feeling comfortable. And we also try to just communicate to people that, look, if you're not comfortable taking on this big of a project, that's where you hire a professional. But certain things, simple maintenance, basic items, are things you can learn to do and should feel comfortable doing.
How has the internet changed this kind of thing? Because I personally have had, how am I supposed to clean the filter on this faucet? How do I take this? I can look online and find it, or I can learn that, oh, this is a job that is beyond my skills. I need to hire somebody for that.
Absolutely. There are great resources, you know, on the internet in terms of, you know, videos, how-to videos, and other things. And, you know, I think it comes down to your comfort level in the end. You know, how comfortable do you feel watching a video and then digging into something? I think you learn anytime with any type of house project, if it starts to become a little bigger than a simple exchange of a faucet or something, there can be a lot more to it. And you can find yourself with a big project or a bigger project than you're anticipating.
That said, it sounds like you're encouraging people to at least think about it and maybe give it a shot. So for the people who do want to do that, give us a little toolkit. What kind of things do we want to make sure we have around the house for those basic projects?
Yeah, I mean, basic hand tools are really important. Screwdrivers, a flathead screwdriver, Phillips head. Also having a hammer, having a screw gun, a drill bits. You know, those are some basic items that can go a long way. The plumbing, there are some pretty specialty tools for plumbing that can really make things easier, but having a basic plumber's wrench and some of those kind of things are really handy. It can let you tackle most projects. So, you know, that's mostly it. Kind of the general hand tools you'd think of, a few power tools. You don't have to go extreme, but those things will get you a long way.
And do you know, you're in Madison, working in the Madison area. Are there classes like this? Are there other nonprofits around the state that teach these kind of classes?
I'm not aware of other nonprofits outside of our region doing this at this point. You know, Project Home is based out of Madison. We work in Dane and Greene County, and so we do things here. But we do, you know, we have been trying to record more of the presentations and put them out there online on our YouTube channel as well to make them available when possible. And so we're hopeful to continue that, at least to share information that way.
And that's the Project Home YouTube channel?
Yeah, Project Home WI, and you can find us.
Great. Jason, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Jason Hafeman joined us in the studio. He's the outreach manager at Project Home. He's been with the Madison nonprofit since 2009, responsible for a series of homeowner classes, including basic household plumbing, cost-effective energy improvements, and more. We talked about some of the basics for homeowners. First, there are a lot of divisions in the United States along the lines of wealth, political belief, race, and religion, to name a few. And on a more basic level, we may be more isolated from one another with fewer opportunities to interact in person with other people in our communities. Our next guest says we can change things for the better by improving what he calls our social infrastructure. That includes things like libraries and parks, even the way we design our buildings and neighborhoods. Eric Kleinenberg is a professor of sociology and the director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. His new book is Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, when we say infrastructure, we might think of water supplies, highways, railroads, that kind of thing. What do we mean by social infrastructure?
It's a different concept, so it's worth just getting it out there as we start our conversation. I define social infrastructure as the physical places and the organizations, places like YMCAs or churches, that shape our interactions. And the social infrastructure, though we haven't really had a name for it, is just as real as all of those other infrastructure systems you described. We know about it too, because when it's working well, when we take care and invest in social infrastructure, we're much more likely to interact with one another, whether it's a planned occasion or a serendipitous encounter that we have with someone we haven't met. And through those interactions, we're more likely to build communities and even to bridge divisions. But when we neglect the social infrastructure, we become far more likely to hunker down and be on our own. Things start to fall apart then. And unfortunately, I think that's the situation we're in now.
And you've written, the first time I heard your name was, I think I booked you to come on our show to talk about the heat wave in Chicago. This is back in the 90s.
And back when we were young, Rob.
Right, exactly. And this is a case where, because of a lack of social infrastructure, you wrote, a lot of people were isolated. A lot of people died, in effect, because they didn't have this social infrastructure in place in particular neighborhoods in a place like Chicago.
That's right. It's not a luxury. Social infrastructure can be a matter of life or death. And I discovered that when I was doing research for the Heatwave book. I found these neighborhoods in Chicago that looked identical demographically. The number of poor people and old people and people who lived alone was identical from a bunch of paired neighborhoods I put together. And what differed was the death rate. One place would have a death rate that was 10 times the other. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what was driving those differences. That the numbers that social scientists usually plug in to figure that stuff out just didn't tell us anything. But what I discovered in the end was it was social infrastructure that mattered. The neighborhoods that had viable sidewalks and active commercial districts that had churches and neighborhood libraries, those places drew people out into public life and they could support one another. But the neighborhoods that had a lot of empty lots and abandoned buildings, that didn't have a lot of stores and diners and coffee shops, that had broken sidewalks, they made it much more likely that people would wind up home and alone. And in the heat wave, that meant they were far more likely to die. But the amazing thing I discovered, probably after we talked, is that it wasn't just the heat wave that mattered. It turns out that if you live in a neighborhood with a robust social infrastructure in Chicago, you're likely to live far longer, up to 5 years, than if you live in a neighborhood where the social infrastructure has fallen apart. And that's even if everything else is equal. So it's a very powerful force in our lives.
I see sometimes people talk about growing isolation in the United States as kind of a natural process. Well, technology, things have evolved along a certain path. And I think, if I'm reading it right, a key message of your book is there are a lot of choices that have been made and that we could make now that determine whether or not we have these flourishing social infrastructures.
Very much so. And, you know, I had this amazing experience because I live in New York City now, even though I grew up in Chicago and spent a lot of my life in the Midwest. But after Hurricane Sandy hit New York, I was asked by the Obama administration to be the research director for a competition called Rebuild by Design, where we worked with these amazing teams of engineers and architects and landscape architects to come up with 21st century infrastructure projects that could withstand the kinds of threats that, well, for instance, that we saw this week or we've been seeing with Hurricane Florence. And when I was working with one of the design teams, they came to me and said, you know, we want to build a resilience center. We have an idea for a place that will be open much of the time, that will have programming for old people and young people and middle-aged people, that will be welcoming, open doors for everyone. And I said, you know, that's a great idea, but it sounds to me like what you're describing is a branch library. And these are places that we could build, or that if we have, that we could do a better job taking care of.
Talking to Eric Kleinenberg, author of the new book, Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Let's stay in the library for a minute. Eric, I should disclose, I'm married to a librarian, so that's out there. you're a big fan of libraries and the role they play in a community. Expand on that a little.
You are. You're probably going to get a very nice dinner when you come home tonight if we play this one right.
I do most of the cooking.
So I think libraries are a tremendous and largely underappreciated resource in American life. And there is this sentiment that you hear often these days that because we have the internet, you know, because we have Google and we carry machines with us wherever we go in our pockets, we just don't need libraries as much. They become obsolete institutions. In fact, over the summer, Forbes magazine published an article saying we should knock down our public libraries and replace them with Amazon shops. So, you know, libraries have a kind of a bad rap. But when I was taking these design teams after Sandy around the region, I started to look into libraries to see just how they were operating as resilient centers. And I have to say, during a time in which it can feel very dark and scary to be in the United States, I mean, who knows what's going to happen here next, walking into a neighborhood library became a source of inspiration for me. I saw all kinds of activities at all hours of the day, including older people who live alone and are at risk of getting isolated, you know, coming together for virtual bowling leagues in the basements of Brooklyn libraries. That's a program they have there. I saw immigrants coming to study English as a second language or take citizenship classes. I saw young people getting exposed to early literacy programs and kids learning different languages. I saw teenagers coming in after school to do homework. I saw a remarkable range of activities that, for me, illustrate the best of what our country is. And I came to realize that libraries are doing so much more than their critics understand, and really, far from being obsolete, they are the paradigmatic social infrastructure these days. They are places where amazing things still happen and we neglect them at our peril.
And you write that one fundamental thing about a library is it's a place that isn't your house that you can go spend time in where you don't have to pay, you know, you don't have to buy a coffee or something to have the right to sit there for more than half an hour or so.
I mean, how many places can you think of that open the doors and ask you what they can give you and not what they can take from you? It's such a strange thing if you step back and think about it. We have inherited this idea that everyone is entitled to access, to free access to our shared cultural heritage, and that we should have it in a safe and comfortable place that's going to be open all of the time and probably close to us. This idea of the library, in some ways, it does seem antiquated, because if we didn't have the invention of a library right now, in this moment we live in where everything is based on market value and we think about costs and benefits in this very simplistic way, and we love technology, we love profit seeking, I can't imagine that we would be capable of inventing the library if it didn't already exist. And so I think it's our job, our responsibility, to protect it and to invest in it, and frankly, to update it for the 21st century, because in addition to those things that I described about the library, it also has become a place of last resort for so many people who slip through the safety net, which now has these gaping holes in it. So I saw lots of homeless people use libraries because it's a warm place and it has a bathroom. I saw people with mental illnesses go to the library because it felt stable and comfortable. I saw people suffering from opioid addiction go to the library because they were counseled to go there by their counselors or by the places where they were getting treatment. And I saw all variety of problems that show up in the library because no one else is paying attention. So if we really want to renew libraries and make them work for 21st century needs, we're going to have to not just grudgingly give them a little bit of a budget to buy new books and fix up the upholstery. We're going to have to think about what it means to reinvent them as vital social infrastructure.
Talking to Eric Kleinenberg right now, professor of sociology at New York University. His new book is Palaces for the People. He argues that public spaces, childcare centers, parks, libraries can help reduce polarization and inequality and help bring us together. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a community activity, a place in your community where you like to go do stuff with other people, not just maybe even your closest friends or family members? Is there a public space that you feel like you participate in? A library, as he's talking about, a park, a pool, a playground, a baseball diamond, a club? Or do you feel like they're missing? You don't have that place in your community. Do you feel like we're too disconnected from one another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the importance of public spaces and fostering community. Eric Kleinenberg is with us, author of the new book, Palaces for the People. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like people in your community aren't connected maybe the way they used to be or the way you think they were in your parents' or grandparents' generation? Do you have that space, a library, a park, a sports facility, a tavern, where you feel like, hey, people from different backgrounds get together and interact with each other in a good way? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Go to your calls now. Anita is with us in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Anita, hi.
Hi. I wanted to just tell you how much I love our library. The Lake Villa District Library in Lake Villa, Illinois. And I have to tell you, I remember when they were a storefront 40 years ago. So what they're doing is fantastic. I don't know if all of the libraries do this, but people don't even realize what a center they are. If you need to find help, if you need to find an organization, an association, a church, whatever, they keep lists, and they will help you find those things. But one of the things that is just astounding now is there's a national movement sponsored by the Foreign Policy Association, and they provide workbooks, which the library has to buy, and the number of people sign up for these once-a-month discussion groups on foreign policy. They can do their own research, but there is a book there, and we do a chapter a month. This is a group of people of varying ages, ethnicities, and believe me, differing political views.
Anita, thanks a lot. I want to jump in there and focus on that last point she made, Eric, because libraries or otherwise, you are worried, and many people are worried, that people of different backgrounds and opinions, as Anita was saying, aren't getting together and talking, and you're hoping that we can revive that.
Yeah, and Anita, I think, gave a beautiful demonstration of all the things that a library can do and things that libraries are doing. We know that too many of us live in an ideological bubble, and we know that we've become more segregated by social class than we have been in quite some time. It can be very difficult when we don't have actual interactions with one another face-to-face to generate civil conversation about the things we disagree on. And if Facebook and Twitter are our primary form of interaction, we will very quickly shout at each other in the most pointless and self-destructive ways. But if you can bring together a group of people who share an interest in ideas in a place like a library or a coffee shop or a playground even, when people are really there to take care of their kids, we get to know each other as people first, and we're then able to enter into a much more humane conversation about the things we value. It's not that we're going to solve the problem of our disagreements, but I think we're able to engage in some civil discourse that gives us a chance of having common purpose. And it's hard not to look at the country as a whole these days and feel that sense of common purpose is really at risk.
Anita, thanks for that call. I want Eric to look at another piece of social infrastructure, but this one, the way you write about it, it's a negative social infrastructure, and that's abandoned buildings. And your chapter on this part of it was excerpted, I saw. Can you talk about abandoned buildings and how they hurt social infrastructure?
Yeah, and I thought a lot about abandoned buildings, having grown up in Chicago in the 1970s and 80s, and I have family in Milwaukee and spent a lot of time there as well, and there's a similar set of issues. Abandoned buildings and empty lots in poor neighborhoods, we now know, aren't just blights. They are also generators of crime. They make it attractive for criminals to use those neighborhoods because they provide a place to hide out or to drop drugs or to find cover. And so there's this group of social scientists and epidemiologists in Pennsylvania who decided to really test this in Philadelphia, where there's more than 40,000 empty lots and abandoned homes. And they did an experiment where, working with the city and a big horticultural society, they randomly selected a set of blocks where they would fix up the empty lots and turn them into simple pocket parks that were well-maintained with wood post fences and occasionally little benches. And they'd also board up the houses. And they found that, compared to the places that they did not fix up, these treated places generated reductions in gun crime of more than 35%. And what's incredible is that reduction continues to last more than a decade. And the crime didn't just get displaced to other areas. It turns out that crimes come not simply from people who are disposed to commit crime, but also from situations. A lot of our criminal activity is situational. If someone thinks they can get away with something at a moment, they will. But if you change the situation, which you can do by fixing up the social infrastructure, you can actually generate durable reductions in crime. And so I think this is a remarkably fascinating and important finding. There are now cities around the country that are trying to replicate what's happening in Philadelphia. And if it turns out that this is really a pattern, it means we have a tool for reducing crime that is not so punitive, that will not result in widespread discrimination or mass incarceration. And it has the added benefit of not only reducing crime, but also when you fix up depleted places, you also make the quality of everyday life better.
Talking to Eric Kleinenberg, his new book is Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and Decline of Civic Life. Let's go to another caller. Gloria is with us in Platteville. Gloria, hi.
Hi, yeah. Thank you for taking my call, and I really like this topic. It's great. I have a question about...
Oop, Gloria, you're breaking up. A note from a producer says Gloria is wondering how to get teenagers and children to want to go to the library and make it more appealing. So taking this part of the social infrastructure, Eric, to the next generation.
Well, you know, to be honest, that's not a problem at the national level or in the general population. If you go to a branch library at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in almost any community in this country, you will see students rushing in the doors, and younger people are rushing in the mornings with their caretakers, in part because libraries offer all variety of services. There are books for people who want to read books, but a lot of kids are going to libraries because they can get internet access. They're using computers. They're learning computer skills. Some are playing video games. But generally what I observed when I was in New York libraries is that kids were using the video games together in a social way that seems strange to someone of my generation, but seems very natural to them. There are all kinds of programs that libraries host that welcome children and treat them as autonomous, independent, creative people. And in fact, one of the most amazing things I heard from so many people, both young and old, is that their early experiences in libraries, you know, getting their own library card, that's their first card. Sometimes it's the first ID that you get. It gives you this license to make your own choices and take your own responsibility, right? A library book is one of the first things you learn that you have to take care of because it doesn't belong to you. And if you destroy it or don't return it, other people will suffer. It's a great civic lesson. So I will confess that as a father myself, there are days when my kids don't want to go to the library because it seems more fun to go play soccer and basketball. But over time, in the course of things, the library offers a lot of great resources and services, and kids like them too.
Thanks for the call, Gloria. Eric, in our last minute or so, supposing a civic leader, you know, elected official or active citizen, whatever, is listening and says, yeah, I want to boost social infrastructure in my community. Give us a 1 minute first step.
Well, the first thing I would say is look at the places that you already have that could be doing more, whether that's a library or a park that's got an athletic field or a playground that hasn't been updated. There's so many resources that are at our disposal that we could improve if we just invested in them. And the other thing I would say is a lot of cities and small towns have old abandoned infrastructure that once served a purpose and that aren't getting used that much. So think about rail lines that in so many communities have been transformed into bike paths these days, and trails, rails to trails programs, or open areas that had a commercial district that start to fall apart that are renovated for open marketplaces. I think our local leaders and all of us as citizens could be more mindful about how to make places come to life and serve as social infrastructure. It's not necessarily massively expensive, but it's certainly one of the things that we're going to have to invest in when we rebuild our infrastructure, as we have no choice but to do in coming years.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Really been my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Eric Kleinenberg, professor of sociology and director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Join us to talk about why investing in public spaces can help people create social bonds. If you've got that space like that in your community, like he was just talking about, send us a note, ideas@WPR.org, and tell us about it. Get ready for something new in the condiment aisle that may not be that new after all. Here's the movie Step Brothers to set it up.
You might want to try this. I make a sauce, we call it fancy sauce.
For me.
That Brennan really likes with his chicken nuggets.
It's my fancy sauce.
Well, when Brennan finishes, I'll give you some of this, and it's ketchup and mayonnaise mixed together.
So good.
I want some fancy sauce.
Yeah.
If you want some fancy sauce, you'll be able to get it. Heinz says its new product combining mayonnaise and ketchup will hit store shelves this month. The creative name, Mayo Chup. People have lots of thoughts about this since it was announced a few months back. Some people say the idea is disgusting. They're wrong. Dipping fries in mayonnaise and ketchup is awesome, so is combining ketchup and mayonnaise on a burger. It's a good combo. Another common objection, though, Heinz didn't invent anything new. Turns out it's a huge thing in Puerto Rico, elsewhere in the Caribbean, and companies like Goya have been selling mayo ketchup in one bottle, mayo ketchup I think it is, for a long time. And it's big in Utah, where it's sold as fry sauce. So there's a running debate over where it was invented. If you can't wait to get it on the store shelves, hey, here's a quick recipe for me to you. Grab that pen and paper. Put some mayonnaise on your plate, then pour some ketchup on it, then stir it together with a fork. Boom! Free culinary advice from Central Time.